I'm Jason Hawk. He's Richard Smith. She's Allison Downing. And this is Remote Patrol, where we use a podcast about TV as a flimsy excuse to get together and talk to each other on the internet. Because I love you guys.
You too, Jason.
How was your week?
I love you
been?
Too.
No, that was too late, Rich. You delayed.
Sorry.
You waited.
Yeah, he doesn't really love us.
There was hesitation. I'm hurt.
There was.
I'm
used to it, actually. There's so much delay in this house.
I am just so horrible to you all the time. That's what it is. Yeah, I understand.
This week has been long, but it's been full of teasing, Richard, so it's been quite good.
Any particular reason for the teasing? Is it related to tonight's topic?
No, he's
why climb a mountain?
It's just there.
There you go.
Just there. That's all.
You guys are doing a great job of helping to take the edge off here, because I'm a little bit nervous tonight. I have done next to zero prep for this show at all.
I feel like I've put in the last few years prep for this show. Ever since we decided that it was this TV show that we were doing, I didn't really do anything.
Well, that's just why I decided not to hardly do anything at all. I mean, normally I've got pages and pages of notes just to get my thoughts kind of organized before we talk, so that I kind of have a general idea, some things that I want to bring up. But this one, I mean, we've watched this so often in my household that it's barely necessary to think about it at all.
Same here. Should we do a show about it? Shall I write out every script in order? What should we do? Because I've seen it that many times.
Shall we pull the quotes out? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we're talking about The Office. I guess we should say that, because now we're, 5 minutes into the show and we haven't mentioned the name of the show that we're actually talking about.
The title of this show will be The Office. So they'll know. It's okay.
Now, to clarify, we're talking about the U.S. office.
Well, it's
the
first thing
office.
That I said, you know, when Rich brought it up, because this Rich was your idea. You said, let's talk about The Office. And immediately I said, the BBC one? Because that's where I thought you were going for sure.
No, don't like that one. Actually, that's totally unfair.
Yeah, that's not true.
Totally unfair.
It's brilliant.
It is brilliant. And they are just two totally different shows that happen to be called The Office. That's pretty much it.
And it's all to do with the way that British humour is handled and the particular way in which Ricky Gervais handles British humour.
I think that you guys have an obsession with making people uncomfortable.
We love that. We love cringing.
Yeah, we do.
As an American, it is very, very difficult to watch Ricky Gervais do his thing on The Office.
Really? It's so uncomfortable to watch him be that socially inept.
There are a lot of British people who have trouble with it for that reason.
It's not really just the American sensibility. It's a thing that transcends the Atlantic.
No, you have a much lower threshold for it than we do, but it's too far even for a lot of British people.
There's the old lark about how you crane your neck to watch the car wreck. And man, that's just what it is with the BBC version. It's just so you can see the punches being telegraphed from a mile out, and that's mixing metaphors. I'm sorry, that's terrible. I'm tired, but whatever. You can see exactly all the bad things that are going to happen, and there's nothing that you can do. You're absolutely powerless to stop Ricky Gervais from just making a complete ass of himself and hurting other people around him.
Yeah, because he's not quite as gentle as his US counterpart. His US counterpart. He's annoying, but he's ultimately quite likable, and you like being around him, whereas David Brent just makes you feel uncomfortable because he's a jerk, and you kind of forget for a lot of time that there's a human being in there that you can connect with, and that is okay, because he's too busy putting up a front of how funny he is. He's a comedian, he's a great boss, but there's no joy about it like there is with Steve Carell's version of The Office Manager.
Yeah, I think based on that alone, this is an interesting comparison of what it gives you time to do when you have many episodes compared to 12 episodes. And so the character of Michael Scott is a much more rounded character. We've had time to see a lot more aspects of his personality. He couldn't just be, if he was as annoying as David Brent for the entire length of run of The Office, by God, would you hate him? Very early on. And so you've got to do it differently.
Now the setup of both shows is roughly the same, and the first six, seven, eight episodes of the US version really are just remakes of the BBC versions, but If people have never seen either version of The Office before, what you have is just a regular workplace where you have a boss who makes an ass out of himself, makes everybody uncomfortable, and people have to deal with the daily grind in a really uncomfortable way. Now, the BBC version goes down a very dark path with that, and it has a very, very sad ending, which I genuinely liked before the U.S. Yeah. Office ever came out. I'm right there with you. I mean, I thought that was very, just a terrific show. But as American television is prone to do, I mean, we have to have happy endings. We have to have light. We have to have fluffy. We have to have people that we can, I don't know, identify with, but we can put themselves or put ourselves in their shoes, kind of a wish fulfillment type thing.
Yeah. And we've got characters in there that are us, because we're Jim and Pam, really. We're the male, female. You are Jim and Pam.
Do you identify yourself as a Jim and Pam?
I think so, because I'm normal, right? I'm US Office. I'm definitely not Phyllis. I'm really, really, really not Angela.
No. Jim and Pam are the ones you meant to identify with, aren't they?
They're the normal everyday
humans. They can see the absurdity going on around them. That's part of it, is that this whole list of characters who are totally absurd as people, and they are completely unaware of that. Mm. And they are.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
All right. See, this is the problem that we always run into, is that there is a half a second delay going across, 3,500 miles or something stupid like that between us?
Yeah.
Makes it easy to jump over each other. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just. They are. They just don't know how ridiculous they all are. And they don't know how ridiculous all the others are. It's a very strange setup, but Jim and Pam are very much aware of that, and they're the only ones. So I think that as the audience, you're meant to feel like you know how absurd everybody is, so you've got to identify with Jim and Pam. They're the ones giving the looks to camera.
Yeah, the ones who are going, can you believe this crap?
Well, that's the reason that Lisa likes it. Lisa, with this should tell you something. My wife, you know, legendarily doesn't like television and movies. She just can't sit still that long, but she loves The Office, which is one reason it's on in our house so much. But she's a little bit in love with Jim Halpert for all of his looks to the camera. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, it was totally perfected by what's-his-face, Martin Freeman, in the UK Office. His incredulous face is still better than John Krasinski's, but that breaking the fourth wall, the knowing nod of, did you just hear that stupid thing? Can you believe I have to sit in this room with these people?
It is worth mentioning that the conceit of the show is that it's all being filmed for a documentary, which kind of gets lost in a lot of episodes, but it allows it to do the single camera thing and to have them do, I don't know what they call it in reality television, where they pull somebody into the special confession room or whatever it is to talk to the camera and give their, you know, their what would normally be their inner monologue.
They're talking heads.
I think they actually manage quite well with, you know, when you do a show that is of a particular style. This actually occurred to me watching Trailer Park Boys the other night.
Yeah.
That if it's done well, it doesn't all need to be, I'm fluffing up what I'm trying to say. What you see doesn't have to be what is technically possible for what it's pretending to be. So, for example, what brought it to my attention was that there were bits in Trailer Park Boys where it was, this would never be, you'd never see this. Mm. This is just, it's a TV show now at this point.
Yeah.
Just for this scene. But you don't really notice it. I've had to watch Trailer Park Boys literally 1,000 times to figure stuff like that out. And The Office is the same. It's not all 100% documentary style.
Yeah.
But the fact that they do it so well that it drags you along.
And in the closing season, it really does become a TV show again, because we start seeing someone behind the camera, someone steps forward that we get to meet, and it becomes a TV show again that they're all interested in watching and trying to figure out just exactly what's been heard about their lives and what's been picked up over the years.
This is late in the series, you said?
This is the very end. The
very last season. It really is. It's the most a TV show in that last season, really.
Full disclosure, I stopped watching right around season 7, because that's when Steve Carell left the show. And I found absolutely no point in watching anymore. Because at that point, it was the Michael Scott show. It was really about watching the boss transform into a likable character. And he completed that arc. And you know, I didn't really need the Jim and Pam thing anymore.
Yeah.
Well, the Jim and Pam thing kind of goes away. Sorry, I totally lost my train of thought.
Well, they were off doing movies, weren't they? I mean, John Krasinski by that point was trying to do a few big screen things, and I can't remember what Pam's real name is, Jenna something, but wasn't she married to James Gunn?
I don't know. I don't know.
I think she was married to James Gunn. She was in Slither, which he did.
Right. I can't say that I've seen them outside of The Office.
I've definitely not seen her in anything outside of The Office.
But, you know, going back to what you were saying about Michael Scott becoming a rounded character, he's kind of finished his arc. What his arc was needing validation, because Michael Scott's entire dream is to be married with children. It's what his whole life is about. He wants to provide for a family and make little Michael Scotts that are also funny and entertain people. And you just sit, you're with him for, in your case, 7 seasons to the point where he leaves, not knowing whether anyone will validate that dream for him. But there's this woman called Holly who's Michael Scott in a skirt. She's just so perfect.
They do a good job of providing him with a woman that is the right person.
Mm.
See, I think after he leaves, I get why a lot of people would lose interest in it. But it survives that transition better than any other TV show I've ever seen. I get that if you just suddenly decided Captain Picard's leaving the Enterprise, you don't really want to watch the next season of Next Gen.
Mm.
You know, but on this...
Especially if you know it's not going to be Captain Riker just acting up as Captain.
But bringing in James Spader was genius. Because he's brilliant.
Well, Spader is brilliant, but here's the thing. I mean, you've ostensibly been with the show from the beginning. Right. Mm. I was. And if Steve Carell no longer feels that there's anything to explore with his character, feels that it's time to move on, then that's kind of telling the audience that there's nothing more there to explore either.
But there were other story arcs. Yeah, I do. But there are other story arcs. And one of the longest arcs is Dwight and Angela.
Didn't you Dwight and Angela went way back, but didn't you kind of feel betrayed when they started to bring other characters in, started to give Andy Bernard lots of focus and the new receptionist, whatever her name was, and then they brought in a ring of new bosses?
I was really cool with it. I thought it was all good. It was difficult transitioning from someone like Michael Scott to D'Angelo, who was a different flavor of insane, but still really insane, too insane to be running that office. Because the thing that we get across over the years is that Michael might be a bit weird, but he gets results and his branch actually does good sales. And you can't understand why, because watching it, no work takes place whatsoever. You know, there's all kinds of strange impromptu meetings in the boardroom about nothing. But he's a good boss. And then you get the craziness of D'Angelo for a very brief period of time, played by Will Ferrell. And then Robert California. Now, Robert California is an amalgam of every James Spader role you've ever seen, distilled into one sexually focused, very powerful, dynamic man.
I heard that he was playing it a little bit wacky too. Was he playing it just clown shoes?
No, not at all.
Very serious.
Hmm.
Very he got his own personal philosophy, very, very well drawn. He knows how he sees the world, and he sees the world in sexual terms. It's all about sexual aggression and pleasure, and everything in life is about sex. So when you get to understanding what his character's like, he's quite withdrawn and he doesn't really tolerate all the tomfoolery in the office. But he don't really do anything.
No, he gets drawn into it one way or another.
Doesn't do any work at all.
He's very bizarre.
Yeah, these aren't small names. I mean, James Spader, you've got, like you said, Will Ferrell, but you didn't mention Idris Elba.
Oh, Idris Elba's in it.
Idris Elba's in it. He comes after Robert California.
Kathy Bates.
No. Kathy Bates owns the company for a time, right?
Idris Elba comes before Robert California because he's just like a replacement for Jen.
Now, he's the really, really serious boss.
He's so, yeah.
And he can't handle it.
He's the one I would want in my workplace because I'm not a Jim. I'm not a Pam. I'm not a Dwight. I'm Stanley. I'm the guy who just wants to get the work done and go home.
Yeah.
Like, I just want someone to do it right so that I don't have to worry about it. You know, I don't want to put up with the boss's stupidity. I don't want to put up with all the corporate hijinks. I just want someone to come in and say, you need to sell A, and then I go and sell A. Mm.
I like the hijinks personally. I think that's why I have to work for myself. Because most people don't like the hijinks.
Yeah. Well, you know, in a normal office, Jim and Dwight would have just been fired for what they get up
they
to.
They would.
Pranking each other. But those prank moments are some of the comedy gold in there. The best moments.
I could have eventually just watched a spin-off called The Jim Pranks Dwight Show. Because they're all genius. I've been trying to think of my favorite ones for tonight.
They're almost like little sketches, aren't they? They just kind of get stuck in there. Almost like this is SNL, but with a recurring theme, with a recurring cast that goes all the way through.
Yeah.
I know what my favorite one is because I've thought about it a long time. Now, if it's the UK office, it's a Stapler and Jelly because the original version of that scene is still wonderful.
It's, yeah.
And I also like the telephone being glued down. In the UK office as well, I really like those two. But in the US office, it was a short race between messages from future Dwight via fax machine.
That's so good. The coffee is poisoned.
Yeah. And the second, and ultimately the winner is when the computer becomes sentient. And starts communicating with him and saying that it's a better salesperson than him. That is personally my favorite.
Obviously over the top, so much so that they wouldn't work except in a sitcom setting. Right. The one that I like is one that you could actually do. It's not particularly clever. It's just funny. It's when Jim dresses up like Dwight and mocks him.
That's got to be in the top five.
Bears beats.
That's got to be in the
Galactica.
Top five.
Galactica. Yeah.
But Asian Jim.
And it all cost him a lot. It's $12 or something like that for the whole outfit.
Asian Jim was hilarious.
Asian Jim was great.
But I'm torn between that one and the Velcro stripper clothes.
Velcro stripper incident. Clothes. Yep. Tearing his clothes off in the parking lot.
It's so quick, that one, where he just runs and grabs, pulls his clothes off and runs off. It's so quick and short. But to think they go as far as like the episode where they make again, this is one Jason White was seeing where they make Dwight think he's doing a radio interview for the whole episode. They really get into it and they make him do some ridiculous things.
They make him admit that he is entirely in charge of Saber and that he is entirely responsible for all the problems that are in the press at the minute. With the company and health and safety, and they get him in his underpants, basically screaming into the phone.
It's just
while
wonderful.
They're all listening in another room. It's wonderful. That was Catherine Tate who was managing towards the end. Catherine Tate is a great British comedian who got exported out there for The Office. Treasure her; she's fantastic.
When she took over. Did it start getting a lot more slapsticky?
Not really.
She was a little bit full of herself at the beginning. She's very quirky. Back to the kind of Michael Scott weirdo. And she does get drawn into the fun. So she becomes this kind of female version of Michael Scott in a way towards the end.
She most blatantly doesn't really want to do anything. So it's kind of always up to be dragged into whatever she can be dragged into, I think.
Yeah. At work, it's fun.
Yeah.
I think another reason why a lot of these kind of jokes worked was because there was no laugh track. You know, Friends was another NBC show. Both The Office and Friends were on NBC a long, long time apart, though. But have you seen the things going around, the clips going around recently online about Friends with the laugh track taken out?
No.
It's absolutely abysmal. It's so terrible. The Friends become loathsome and stupid people. They're not those, you know how, I guess what was really attractive about Friends is that they were supposed to be the cool older siblings who moved to the city. And yeah. When you take the laugh track out, they just turn into these dull, dumb people.
Yeah.
When NBC isn't telling you exactly when to laugh. And The Office, I think the humor succeeds because there are no laughs. There's no cues. It's just, it's imperative on you and on the timing of the actors to figure out what's funny and why.
You know what, though? It's honestly because we're British and we do that a lot. We don't need telling when to laugh. If it's funny, it's genuinely funny. We have lots of sitcoms that do put laugh tracks on, but they're a different breed entirely. We have a brand of British comedy that has never told you when to laugh.
Suppose a bit. I'm just remembering the series of Red Dwarf where they took the laugh track off, and it was
awful, because situation comedies kind of need it, and it does help, because you do laugh to tell other people that you're enjoying it and that you're having a good time. That's why we laugh.
There's kind of a social hypnosis that goes on. Yeah. A groupthink that happens. But, I mean, that might work for Seinfeld, but it wouldn't work for 30 Rock, I don't think, if they put a laugh track in. It wouldn't work for Arrested Development if they put a laugh track in. Yeah. I'm thinking of all these modern day, I think much, much, much better situation comedies that don't have one. They're single camera, non-laugh track, not filmed in front of a live audience.
Curb Your Enthusiasm is probably the closest you guys get to that kind of brand of comedy.
Ah, you know, here's a good example. You guys love Scrubs too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, I think that we've discussed doing Scrubs on this show, and I think, Rich, you kind of groaned and said, I can't watch it one more time, right?
Yeah, that would be my attitude if you suggested it now, so I wouldn't be surprised if I've said that in the past.
I recently did shotgun a whole bunch of it, and I got through about 4 seasons late at night before I just said, you know what, I can't take any more Scrubs ever. I think I'm done. But there is the one episode where it kind of goes into this prolonged full episode dream sequence where Scrubs becomes a laugh track sitcom.
Yeah, I remember the one.
And they absolutely tear the format apart. They mock it mercilessly, and they show just how bad it could have been had NBC decided to do it with a Cheers sensibility or a Night Court sensibility.
Yeah.
I think both methods work, but not for the same content. There's just the times when it's relevant and times when you should stay away from it.
Mm.
I don't know how you decide before you're making it. You know, it's easy for us to sit here now and go, yeah, Scrubs shouldn't have a laugh track. But we've seen it without a laugh track.
I think, you know, things that have got a certain amount of physical or slapstick about them tend to work better. Things that are performed live in front of an audience to get that kind of audience atmosphere that comes across on the show.
It really used it's to.
Different kind of humor.
Yeah, it used to really bother me as a child. I didn't get it. Do you know what bothered me? Was the fact that you'd think there was laughing there because there were people in a studio watching it. And then you'd have a scene that was outside and the laughter would still be there.
Yeah.
How?
Yeah.
If there's no one stood, they're not, did they all shuffle outside, put their coats on to watch this scene being filmed?
They are thinking of things like British comedies like Heidi High, which definitely was of that ilk, where you have your inside and outside shots, but there's still a laugh track going on.
Yeah. If we ever suggest that we're doing Heidi High, you've done something really shit to us, Jason.
We're not doing Heidi High.
Yeah. I have no context for it whatsoever.
No. It's a very old, actually probably not as old as I'd like to think it is. It's a British sitcom set in a 50s holiday camp, like Butlins. That might even require further explanation.
Yeah.
But it's horrible. Horrible, very much of its time, and, you know, just terrible. But it was a well-known British sitcom. But yeah, it does not surprise me you've never heard of it.
I think it's all about the writing structure. Because the old sitcom style that used to use laugh tracks was beat, beat, joke, beat, beat, joke, beat, beat, joke. And when you're doing that, it's really easy to work in the laugh track or the live audience, either one.
Yeah.
What The Office tends to do, and what really good shows, I think, tend to do, Arrested Development being way, way, way up on this list, especially with this thing, is that they switch up the order of the joke. They give you the punchline, then they go back and they add what the setup is. Mm. So it's almost like you're restructuring the joke in your mind as it goes on, and then you feel like you're the one who's telling it.
Yeah, and you're completely in the know. It's kind of your story now because you've worked it out.
And I don't think that there's a way to insert the laughter when that happens. Because it's more of like, it's not a tough puzzle, but it's still solving a puzzle. Like, oh, I get that thing that they said 30 seconds ago now.
Yeah. But I also think, you know, if things are funny enough, you don't need telling one to laugh, do you?
It almost takes away from it if they do tell you. I mean, you're right. There's a social aspect to it where sharing the laughter with people, even if they're fake people, is sometimes helpful. But when they're forcing you to laugh at something that's not funny, it's even worse. And you can turn on CBS at any given time for perfect examples of this. I mean, Two and a Half Men, or what is it? What's the one with the two girls who are waitresses?
Oh.
Don't know.
Two Girls with Waitresses.
Yeah. You might as well just label the shows that at this point, is a short description of the premise.
Yeah. I know which one you mean, but I don't know what it's called. And I'm not going to research that either.
No.
I don't know.
I can't even get
to think what that show's called. That's terrible. But it's because it's a terrible show and I don't really want to watch it because, you know, laugh tracks do kind of offend me. On a base level, yeah.
Well, I think that they were more forgivable a while ago, but now they're almost kind of anesthesia. The laugh tracks are there to show you, hey, you don't have to think too hard about this. Just relax. It's almost bedtime. You're going to be fine. And the non-laugh track shows are like, okay, it's time to engage because we're going to get you really involved in this premise. We're going to show you that Michael Scott is unintentionally funny, even though he's sympathetic and he can say really bad things. But under all, he's got a heart of gold. And here's why you should like him. And here's a bunch of supporting jokes to throw in there into the mix. Get ready. Mm. I mean, it's much more complicated.
It is. It requires more of you.
It's still not calculus. But it's more, it's more complicated than the second grade math that CBS is throwing at you.
What does CBS make? I'm guessing Big Bang Theory.
I actually like Big Bang Theory, so let's not.
I like Big Bang Theory. It tells me when to laugh, but it's appropriate. It is appropriate.
See, the laugh track doesn't bother you there.
No, because it works. It's one of those good sitcoms that doesn't treat me like I'm an idiot. You know, it's an okay one because it is funny and it's live studio audience stuff, so it's not from a can. You know, you can definitely tell, like you were saying about, the outdoor shots, that's can, that's not real, that's somebody pressing play.
I used to like to think that they show it to the audience on video screens and record them laughing at it. That's how it works in my imagination. I don't know if it works.
Well, they're in front of a live studio audience, like Tool Time and, you know,
yeah,
Home Improvement, those kinds of shows. There really are people there. If they find it funny in the moment, then it worked and it's good and it's okay. But if it was like, ha ha ha, ha, ha.
That's how Friends used to work. They'd work with the audience to make the show funnier.
Yeah.
You know, they'd often like, does that joke work? Did you all get that? Or was that stupid? And change the script as they're filming it to make things, because that's what you need, like 300 people sat behind you, and if they laugh then it's funny, you know.
Okay, here we go. So in addition to the ones that we've already said, other CBS sitcoms, other lowest common denominator sitcoms include Mom, the Anna Faris one with CJ from the West Wing, and it's just, oh man, it's groan worthy. You cannot watch that one.
I don't think that's made it over here. Mike and Molly's over here, which is absolutely just like insipid. King of Queens, but just bigger.
Right. Two and a Half Men. The name of two waitresses is really Two Broke Girls.
Two Broke Girls, that's the one, yeah.
The Millers, which is the one with Joe Bluth, which tries to be Home Improvement, but its writing is about a third of what Home Improvement ever could be.
Yeah.
That's generous. I'm gonna back that off. I'm gonna say 3%. Home Improvement was a good show.
It was. Yeah, it was a good show. Great show.
Last year, the audience, a little bit of physical comedy in there with the next door neighbor who you never quite see. That conceit's carried over to the audience that's watching it live, and it works.
You know, they never got to see him.
Did they not?
Even at the end of the taping, when the cast would come out and take a bow, he had a small handheld fence that he would hold up over his face.
That's wonderful.
You didn't even get to see him if you went and saw them tape the show.
That kind of stuff is funny, and it's a live studio audience conceit that works. It comes across the TV.
Of course, his name is Earl Hinman, and he plays Kevin Costner's brother-in-law in the movie Silverado. So if you want to see him, that's it. He's in that. He gets shot, though. Doesn't die. His house burns down. If you haven't seen Silverado by now, you really don't want it. Brilliant, though. It's got cowboys and everything. Enough of that. Sorry.
I've got to look now. Is Wilson dead or not?
He is. I think he died a couple of years ago.
I'm looking at Wikipedia. I've got to find out. Earl Hinman, December 29th, 2003. Yeah, he's dead.
Oh, that's a lot longer ago than I imagined it being. Anyway, The Office. Where were we? Yeah, I think you should watch the last two seasons. Like, don't make a special point of it, but don't be afraid of them either.
I will put it to bed, you know, because there's things about the characters, some evolutions that are not really that comfortable, and you begin to change your opinion of some people and get frustrated with people and choose sides that you never thought you were going to choose before. And you see the conclusion of Angela's car crash marriage and Oscar's love affair with the same person and who is the baby's father. And it's really, really worth watching it all the way through, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think one of the strengths of The Office is that you do care a lot about those side characters, because I could sit and tell you an awful lot about Oscar Nunez.
Yeah.
Than I ever suspected. I mean, what a good character, right?
Yeah.
He's a great character. And I equally love Toby. Some of it because Michael dislikes him. Some of it because Toby's quite sly. I appreciate the slyness and his unrequited love in The Office.
Interesting fact about Toby.
Yeah.
Toby was only ever supposed to be on the show as a one-off. He was never supposed to come back. And apparently some executive saw him and said, hey, that guy's really funny. Put him on more often. Mm. And I guess he really hated being on screen.
What, wasn't he the showrunner for a while?
I think he was a writer.
Right. A lot of them wrote a lot of writing credits
and directing credits along the way.
Mindy Kaling wrote a whole bunch of them.
Yeah. BJ and Oleg did a load.
This spawned a lot of careers, this show.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people we'd not have heard of if not for The Office. Not including Steve Carell, though, because he was kind of... It was weird. It was, you know, it always is weird when someone has a very successful film career alongside a successful television career, and you kind of feel one of those is going to be kicked off at some point, and he chose
to... Would you say, though, that Steve Carell had a very successful film career?
I think he's considered pretty good.
I don't see.
He's just been nominated for a Best Actor Oscar.
He was, yeah. And it's probably the best role he's had since Michael Scott. I thought Date Night was appalling. That was a rubbish film. 40-Year-Old Virgin was great.
Probably his defining role.
Definitely. And his couple of moments in the Anchorman movies are okay, but they're not his film.
Hang on. Well, you know, I think it was Brick Tamlin that helped him a lot as well as a character to play. 70 acting credits here on IMDb for Steve Carell. He's had a very successful career. Pre and post office. Because I'm just looking now. As you said, Bruce Almighty, Anchorman.
That's funny, that is really funny.
Technically both before the 40-Year-Old Virgin. You know, so they show up on there. But then he started doing serious acting as well, because he did Little Miss Sunshine.
He did, yeah.
Which is a good movie, sure.
Yeah.
You know, Down in Real Life, I haven't seen that, I don't know. Get Smart was the first sort of slapstick, silly kind of movie that he headed up. I actually quite enjoyed it. I can understand that it didn't set the world on fire or whatever, but I didn't think it was bad. And then
Are you kidding me?
I really didn't think it was bad. How bad can
you
it be?
You and I, sir, now have a feud. We are feuding. Consider yourself feuded.
Okay.
I don't know that I've seen it, but...
It wasn't bad. I might just be like, hey, it had Anne Hathaway in for an hour and a half, so
right,
I'll
okay, yeah,
it.
I hear you.
That might be it. Now, Dinner for Schmucks, which was a film that we were all so angry about and really against when we heard about it, because it's a remake of a really good French film. Perhaps the second best French film I've seen, because I only like two of them. So...
Is hilarious. If you haven't seen it, it doesn't matter. Read the subtitles. It's hilarious. So I'd seen it and fallen in love with it. We'd both howled laughing watching Dinner de Con. And then it's like, okay, they're remaking it with Steve Carell in the role as the idiot. Oh no.
But it is to Dinner de Con what The Office US is to the UK Office.
Exactly.
It's a different thing.
Treat them like a different beast and it's really okay.
You like Crazy Stupid Love? We are everyone like
that's
that?
That's an incredible film.
That can't just be so good just because Ryan Gosling takes his shirt off.
No, it's actually a really good role for Steve Carell.
I guess that by any concrete measurable metric that you go by, yes, he's been successful. Yes, he's a good actor. Yes, he's had a great career. But I think it was the combination. I mean, between 2005 and now, he's done Bewitched, the movie, which was...
Well, no one came out of that.
I got dragged to that.
Yeah.
Did Evan Almighty. And then there was the string of Get Smart, Date Night, and Dinner for Schmucks. And, you know, it was just like bam, 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 all in a row. And I think that really just kind of jaded my opinion of him from there on. No matter what he's done, I mean, I don't think that there's any coming back from that 1-2-3 punch.
Mm. I don't know. Maybe it was damaging. I wish he'd not done Dinner for Schmucks, but if they're making Dinner for Schmucks, I'm glad it was him.
They handled that okay.
It was okay. It's not Dinner de Con. It's nowhere near the quality of it. It just isn't. I'm okay. I'm really, really happy at watching people acting and being funny in a language that's not my own with people that I don't recognize.
Mind you, as I said, I watched Foxcatcher and I've never been as bored in my entire life. Really, really boring, boring film.
Right.
Just didn't like that at all. Didn't like it in the least. It's not The Office, though.
Yeah.
And then there's the snap judgment of Alexander and the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day, where you're just kind of like, I mean, I haven't gone to see it. It might be the most brilliant children's movie that has ever been made, but you look at that preview and you say, really? Has he come to this? Has he started doing movies for his kids now?
I don't know. Maybe he's just dead easy. I don't know. But he's just been in several films a year for the last, nearly 10 years. In fact, 40-year-old version is a 10-year-old film.
Is that?
Yeah, okay. 2005.
That's crazy.
That went quick.
So, yeah, I'd argue he's doing very well.
He is.
11 upcoming projects.
I still prefer Michael Scott to all of them. I don't care. I know it's difficult when you've been in a role for some time and you've been that same person to ever be seen as anyone else other than that one monolithic character that you were, and I think he suffers from that for me. I want him to be Michael Scott. I want Steve Carell to actually be Michael Scott and not be acting, because he looks so effortlessly being Michael Scott. So it mustn't be a stretch. It must really be like that. And that, maybe that's what I like. It's so effortless. He could be him. What I don't like is I can't see him as anyone else. Michael Scott. Best boss in the world.
I'm just looking over Steve Carell's.
I think the mug speaks for itself.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just caught up in Steve Carell's future projects, and there's a few that I would not have greenlighted here.
Is there?
Yes. Acme Warehouse Project. There's so many untitled project Like, just make a film where X is the case, and then you make a film. This one's Acme Warehouse Project, a story set in the Acme Warehouse, the manufacturer of anything and everything used by the Looney Tunes characters. How, that's not a film. That is not a movie. That's just somebody's thought, wouldn't it be good if there was this warehouse where that stuff was? And that's going to have like $120 million spent on it. An untitled lottery comedy. Steve Carell probably wins the... Oh no. One guy is left out when all the other residents in his town win the lottery except him. That's actually... I'd watch that. Sorry. Let's get back to it. Yes. I'll put that down. What else should we say about The Office then? It's one of my very favourite TV shows of all time.
Yeah, it's like a mate, isn't it? Mm. It's like a buddy that you see every now and again. And I will never complain that you've put an episode on. It'll never be an inappropriate time to watch it.
It's 22
minutes of brilliance.
I've had some friends who have been absolutely rabid about The Office, and I was an evangelist for The Office when it was in its first four seasons, but then I've also had some friends who have been extremely critical of it, saying that it's just a bunch of very stereotypical, very cliched love triangles, that it really is just a soap opera that happens to be set up like a comedy. What do you think about that claim?
Some people think global warming isn't real and that they've been abducted by aliens. That's my response to that. You're entitled to think what you want. It doesn't mean you're not crazy or that you're right.
I think I know what they're saying, though, is, you know, there's the Ross and Rachel thing, and how many seasons can you go on with Ross and Rachel not getting together, and does The Office kind of mimic that just to string it along?
I would
Jim
argue
and Pam,
no.
Are they going to get together? Dwight and Angela, are they going to get together? Andy and Aaron, are they going to get together?
But what I think I like about that is that there was no sense of... Well, if they do, then that's the end of the story, because there's only one story. There's not only one story, there's loads. And even after a wedding and children, there's still a story.
Yeah, that's true. Things move on. I mean, with the UK version, they had to make a Christmas special for Tim and Dawn to get together, because that didn't even happen by the end. And whereas with the American Office, that... Jim and Pam get together pretty early on. Mm. And then so you get to see them have other problems, like having kids and moving on from there. And for the last season, Pam's just a fucking bitch. Which is one reason, if you like Pam, don't watch the last season, actually. Because you get to the point where you say, oh, I'd divorce you now. But, you know.
Well, it is nice when a comedy will veer away to handle some of the... like post-dating relationship drama, kind of get real. But at the same time, I don't know, it's this weird double standard that I guess I hold in my head, because yes, I want them to handle things that are more than just the cliche, but at the same time, I watch the show because it is idealistic, because maybe if I'm having relationship problems, which I'm not, my wife is pretty awesome. but let's say that I were having them, I would watch TV as an escape to watch the beautiful people have their perfect relationships.
What I enjoy about it is that it makes me kind of wish I worked there. And when things, I enjoy when a sitcom pulls you into its less than ideal situation to the degree that it makes you want to live there or be part of it, then I think they've kind of done something right.
There is a perfect relationship in The Office. It's Phyllis's with Bob Vance.
Vance Refrigeration.
Bob Vance Refrigeration.
Yeah. That is a perfect marriage. She loves him so much. When he gets a chance to buy a kiss off his wife, he buys a kiss off his wife. They're utterly in love with each other, and there's never a question of, are they going to fall out? Is there going to be an argument? Will they ever last? Of course they will. It's Phyllis and Bob Vance Refrigeration. They're going to be together forever. Whereas everybody else has got more of a story, more flux in their life. And what I particularly like is that over the entire arc, Dwight becomes a human being. Because he's not at the beginning. He's a gargoyle. He's a ridiculous figure of fun. and there's one person who can bring about the human in him.
I maintain that the whole the office as a whole is the story of Dwight and Angela, and that the Jim and Pam thing is just a red herring at the beginning.
Yeah.
Saying the office is about Jim and Pam is like saying Psycho is about a woman who steals $40,000.
Yeah.
It's not. You just think it is for a bit. It's actually about the mother in the basement. That's what it's about. It's about Dwight and Angela. And Dwight's journey to become, like, say, a human being, because he most definitely is not.
Now, up until just this moment, we've hardly mentioned Dwight at all. And let me ask you this. Do you find him to be insufferable by about the eighth season?
No.
Oh, I get where you're coming from. It can. There's a lot that gets a bit much, but at the same time, I think they do go some way to improving him. They
Dwight,
really do.
Dwight, after a while, is somewhat of a one-trick pony. He's a one-note piano, other mixed metaphors, whatever. But he's really only doing one thing, and I really hope that that changes in the later seasons, because Rainn Wilson himself, I've seen him in a few interviews, and he seems like a kind of nasty guy. You know, NBC tried to do the whole Dwight Schrute Farm spinoff, and that didn't take off. So I'm wondering if there's any more dimension to that character or to that actor.
I think that it does come via Angela, and if what Dwight does, I don't know whether you got to the point where he'd got power, he actually on the building. Did you get to the point where he owned the building?
I think that happened so season 6 or 7 when he owns the building.
I didn't know that part, no.
The thing about Dwight is his Germanic sensibility of being superior, knowing, frugal, austere, and likes to throw his power around. There is key sort of leadership qualities. That's how he wants to be ruling with an iron fist, and he doesn't care how austere those conditions are. And that's beautifully illustrated with his provision of a creche, which, if you haven't seen, Jason, I urge you to watch, because it's brilliant. So he starts treating people quite badly, and that becomes a template for him for quite a long time, but they have nice conceits where they drop it, and we're shown, actually, he really does love these people. They are his friends. He really values them, and the last thing he'd want is to break the friendship that he's got around him.
He's like a naughty child that he tries to push his boundaries within the world that he lives in, that he doesn't want to move out into a different world. He likes where he is, but he's going to rattle the cage while he's there as much as possible.
It's not Asperger's, it's not autism, it's not any of those really easy labels that other shows have used. What is it about Dwight? I mean, of course he's socially inept, but is it just mommy
weird
issues?
He's just eccentric. He's eccentric. I think he's European in sensibility. And, you know, a lot of it's about his upbringing, and it is about austerity and fear and all that kind of stuff. You know, the traditions that he has within his family and the kind of rituals that they do on a yearly basis. It's dark. So the more you get to hear about, you know, his lifestyle as a child and what Christmases and birthdays were like, you're like, well, of course you became Dwight. Of course you're you.
I actually think this is a difference between American and English sensibilities about eccentric people. That I think that over
we
here,
love an eccentric,
the
don't
phrase
we?
Eccentric, I would use in the same context that I would use the description black or gay or whatever. Oh, he's an eccentric. And that, in my head, I know what you're talking about now. That's fine. And everyone else is cool with that as well. It's not
it's
a bad thing.
Yeah, it's just a bit out there.
It's just, it's meant in total acceptance. We've given it a name. This person is one of these types of people. That's cool. Because over here as well, we think they invent things in sheds, but that's a weird thing as well.
They're much more insular and quiet than Dwight would ever be. Yeah. Dwight likes to be loud and proud about his life. Lifestyle and how to do things correctly. You know, he's that kind of Teutonic personality. It is like this because that is why it is like this.
I also
hold on. You used the word Teutonic. You get the bell.
Did I? Wow.
That was beautiful. That was gorgeous.
Oh, thanks. That's just made my day.
I'm so impressed. Now, can you give a definition?
I'm glowing. Yeah, Germanic. kind of. This is how it is. You know, I've met enough Germans in my life, and yeah, I've liked all of them. Actually, I've liked every German person that I've ever met. But they are peculiar.
I could go for 2 months without hearing someone use the word Teutonic in conversation. I just can't stop glowing here about what you've done.
There must be one a day, Jason. It's a shame we don't talk every day. You'd get a lot of action out of that bell.
Excuse me. I'm crying.
It's okay. It's on record. You know that it was, it's the 27th here, but for you, it's the 26th of February, 2015, and Allison said Teutonic.
I think that that's probably a pretty good place to wrap this up, because we've got Atomic Trivia War 9000 that we're taping next. And honestly, without breaking down and doing the, hey, you remember when you were with the Beatles kind of thing?
Yeah. You know,
from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
That was cool. I don't think that you can really say much more about The Office.
You can't really.
I think we covered it good. I feel pleased we did it, though. Very pleased.
Comedies and sitcoms are always very difficult to talk about, because it does really just break down into, hey, that joke was funny, and don't know why, kind of an esoteric joke thing. So let's just quote the jokes.
Well, I think with the longer ones like The Office, there's a lot more scope to discuss stuff. It certainly wouldn't work on anything less than, say, 5 seasons, probably.
You know much more about everybody, don't you? Ass,
by the way, that's based on nothing. What do I know?
You know so much more about the people, and you get invested in them as their human stories, not just for what comedy they can bring and who's the funniest.
Yeah.
There's no competition who's the funniest. That's what I really like about it. You know, the jokes are spread well evenly amongst the team, and everybody gets a few hits per show.
Next week, Frasier.
Is it?
No, I'm just making I just said that now. Is it? Anyway. Let's wrap up the show.
Okay.
We should just say thank you for listening, everybody. There'll be another show next week on a different TV show. And check out Atomic Trivia War and Rich and Allison's Super Happy Fun Time. And all the others.
They're all
on simplysyndicated.com. You know that. You're all clever people. Okay. Do I say it? Bye-bye, everybody.
Teutonic.